Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host, and it's Friday here. I know it's Saturday morning where a lot of our listeners are in Australia and over in the Philippines and Singapore and wherever else on the other side of the dateline, but it's Friday here, and we like to do have some fun on Fridays a lot of the time. And for me, there is nothing more fun than having a good chat, just sitting around chatting. I love that. And we got two great folks to talk with. There's so much going on in the world and in the church, and every now and then we like to have these panel discussions where we kind of put together a little panel of folks and we just talk about what's going on, and that's what we're going to do. You're welcome to participate, 888-318-7884, if there are things in the world that you would like to discuss, but it's a little off our beaten path. We're just going to have a conversation. We're not going to try to solve all the world's problems. We're not going to try to answer apologetics questions. And, you know, we're just going to try to talk about what's going on. And I have two great guests, as I said. First, I got to remember in order of importance. Oh, yeah, president comes before apologist. So first, Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, not really in the importance of things, but happy to be here, Cy. Thank you very much. But are they allowed to, you mentioned Australia.
Yeah.
Are they allowed to listen to Catholic Answers live? Because, everything is locked down.
I know. I actually was talking with some folks in Australia last week because they invited me to participate in a rosary that they do.
Right.
Have you ever done that rosary with them, with the group?
Is that with our friends at Perugia?
Yeah. Yes. And it was lovely to get to do it. But afterwards, we were just kind of chatting. I didn't actually go to Australia, just to be clear. This was via Zoom or Skype or something like that. But man, Australia, you can't travel between states in Australia. Like if you're in Victoria, you can't go to New South Wales.
And mercy.
They told the story of this kid who, one of the older boys from this huge Catholic family, he's got a girlfriend in a different state than him. So he canoed across a lake.
I love that kid.
Yeah.
Can we get him on the show?
That's the spirit, kid. Come on. Don't let the authorities keep you away from her. So it does sound quite strict in Australia. Hey, our other guest is Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, also a lawyer, also a former seminarian, also a father and a husband.
And a father again recently.
Yeah, a father twice over. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Have you ever done that rosary thing down in Australia?
I have not, I've done the rosary, but not in Australia. Is it just upside down?
No, it's
does it go like counterclockwise?
You have to stand on your head and say the rosary.
You start right in the middle of the third decade, right? Because your whole rosary is upside down.
Right.
Borealis effect or something like that. I think I've heard of that.
Yeah. Oh, the one thing I wanted to see when we were in Australia was the Southern Cross. And I knew
it was cloudy.
It was cloudy at the time.
And then there were
a few clear nights, but then I forgot to look on those nights. So I still haven't seen the Southern Cross. So you both ready to talk about the issues of the day?
Not at all, but that's all right. Never stopped me.
How about you, Joe?
Yeah, I think that never stops anyone from talking about the issues of the day.
No, that's probably right. Joe, I can't see you. Do we not have you on video right now?
I got a new computer this week, and this is my first time trying to use the webcam with it, which, you know, shows my amount of preparation.
Thanks.
Yeah. And it turns out it's a...
Thanks for putting the hours in, Joe.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully after commercial, we'll be able to see me. But until then, you've got a brief respite from it.
I've got a new computer and a bright future in sales.
That is from a song by...
Fountains of Wayne. Right?
See, you know so much of that stuff. I don't know it. I remember being in a contest. It was what do you call those contests? A music trivia contest.
Oh, there's some folks here in the building who really like that.
And I think there was, I think Patrick Madrid was with us that time. He's insane. The amount of music he knows.
He is a pop music enthusiast. He's wrong about a number of things too. I'm just going to say it on the air right now.
Really about?
about it, with respect to his musical taste.
Oh, I see. Because he likes the Beatles?
He does. He does.
He loves the Beatles.
He does.
All right, I want to talk to you about Columbus Day a little bit, because it struck me on Columbus Day that pretty much everything we do in our society is a fight. We got to fight over it. We just can't let each other be on anything. So... to me, I'm not really enthusiastic for all the fighting, and certainly not over something like Columbus Day, where I thought a lot of disingenuous or just wrong. I don't know how to categorize them except wrong things were said about the actual man, Christopher Columbus. And I don't think that the people who say them actually care about that. That what they care about is that the native people, the indigenous people of the Americas, get credit for, you know, being God's children and being important and having their story told. And I think that that's backwards. I don't think you have to lie about Christopher Columbus to get that other laudable goal done. What did you two think about Columbus Day this year?
I'm not even certain, Cy, that they want to give the native peoples credit for being God's children.
Well, maybe they don't believe in God.
Yeah, I'm quite serious. Yeah, I think the unifying principle of all of this reaction or outrage or vitriol or is a hatred of Christianity because yeah, the rest of it collapses on its own contradictions. Christopher Columbus is one of the most extraordinary men in history. He was certainly a genius at navigation. He had an additional sixth sense, if you will, for just knowing where he was on the open sea. And even later, by the time of his fourth voyage, when he does in fact come to what is now South America, that is a continent, he knows he's not on an island.
He could tell by the flow of the rivers, I think.
The river, the smell of the place, the diversity of the plant life.
Yeah.
So in any case, he was an extraordinary navigator and a man of remarkable daring. And he did what he did when a lot of people were telling him he was going to fail. Now, of course, no one was saying to him, you're going to sail off the edge of the earth. Nobody believed the earth was flat. That's something Nathaniel Hawthorne and other
Washington
people.
Irving.
Washington Irving, thank you. Yeah, I was kidding. See, you know why? It's because of that card game, Authors. Do you remember that card game?
Oh, I've never played that.
Well, it was a card game that our
parents... No one could beat you at that. Well, you're crazy with your memory of literary things.
Well, I just, you know, made that mistake. Oh, but in any case, thank you, Washington Irving. But there were people telling him, you have miscalculated the size of the earth.
And he had.
Yeah,
but he,
yes,
but
they were right.
Yeah,
yes,
they
exactly.
were right. And by the way, they were Dominicans. They were Catholic priests.
But the thing is, Columbus had been all the way past Iceland already.
Yep, it's true.
And he had seen the Atlantic currents. And he thought, I can go get all the way through my water and my food and everything, but the currents will get me there, you know, that the currents will be in my favor. And so he was wrong, though. We act like, oh, Columbus was this brave guy that knew the world was round and all these Catholics thought the world was flat, which is a complete lie that perpetuated in the 19th century by Washington Irving, American author. But the truth is, he was the one that was wrong. He just got really lucky.
Yeah, had there not been a continent there,
He wouldn't have made it.
No, he would not have. But nonetheless, he had the strength of his convictions, and he was able to motivate his crews, and he was something of a self-promoter. But I have a feeling that if I had his skill set, I might succumb to some of that as well. And he was constantly having to defend himself, even after he had shown what he had done. He was constantly having to defend himself. And the thing that happened, what historians nowadays call the Columbian Exchange, the thing that happened where two worlds completely unknown to each other are now united inseparably for the rest of time, the thing that happened because of what he did is such a significant event in history. I mean, second probably only to the incarnation in human history.
It's astounding. And he also certainly was not the first European to set foot in what we now think of as the Americas.
Oh, are we going to get an apology for the Vikings here?
No.
Yes, I was.
But he certainly was not. But he was the one who made that exchange possible.
Yes.
I mean, certainly Leif Erikson did not make that exchange.
No, they
possible.
Didn't hang around.
Yeah.
They. But so in any case, and then I'll say this also, he had a a good and Christian motive. He was trying to raise money to finance another crusade to take back the Holy Land from Islamic tyranny, and he definitely understood himself in a kind of a mystical and even eschatological way very well. But all we want to hear about now is that as a consequence of what he did, native peoples in this hemisphere were enslaved, were abused, were the victims of genocide. On the last score, sure, there are examples, but most of the decimation of the population is unintentional as a consequence of communicable diseases.
Right, and no matter who got here first, that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm going to get your take on Columbus and Columbus Day, but we got to do it after the break. We have to take our first break. We're going to be talking the news of the day. We're going to talk about space travel. We're going to talk about some what's happening with the Roe versus Wade situation here in the U.S. and the whole abortion kind of elimination movement, of which I am proudly a part. But we'll talk about all that and many more things, maybe things that are on your mind, when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
By providing quality programming faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church, EWTN is television that viewers can trust. Whether it's films, documentaries, news coverage, lively discussion shows, or kids programs, we highlight the truth that is the eternal word. For a complete schedule of EWTN television programs, visit EWTN.com and click TV. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. I think Chris Check, our president, who's one of our guests today, along with Joe Heschmeyer, one of the apologists here, put his finger on the reason why this is important to us, is that there's an anti-Christianity, obviously, in many of the things that are said about Christopher Columbus. I mean, it's not – well, that's it. That's what's at the root of it. I, as a white Christian – I can't help it. I can't help the Christian part.
Not anymore.
No, at this point, I can't.
Yeah.
No, at this, but all, as Pope Benedict says, all the major decisions have been made.
Yeah.
When you hear those two words together, white Christian, you never hear that in a positive sense.
No.
Like, man, I just love those white Christians. No, that's always used as a negative thing. And you're a great historian, Chris.
I am an amateur student of history.
You are a great amateur student of history. But like, I was giving a talk one time, and it required to do a kind of a brief history of Christianity. And somebody got up at the end of the talk and asked me, well, why do you focus so much on Europe, as if only European Christianity matters? And I said, because in the 7th and 8th century, Christianity was cut in half by Islam, by a violent, murderous invasion of Islam across North Africa and Arabia that cut Christianity in half. The apostles went out in all four directions, and they were very successful in Africa, in Asia, and in Europe. But the church was cut in half by Islam in the 7th and 8th. That's why this meme or this idea of the white, as if Christianity belongs to white people. It doesn't. Long before Europe was Christian, there were Christians in Persia, and there were Christians in India, and there were Christians in Ethiopia. In the Bible, there's a Christian in Ethiopia. You know, so before even the writing of the Bible, what happened was Islam chopped Christianity in half.
And occupied the East.
Yeah, and occupied
and,
it.
And continues to.
And left the Europe to fend for itself when Europe was poor. Europe was a poor backwater of violent tribes, and that's all that was left for Christianity. And in 1,000 years, Christianity transformed those European cultures into something like the world has never seen before. So this idea that it's a white thing, that Christianity, and that somehow we can dismiss Christopher Columbus because he's part of that white. No, Christians have from the beginning gone everywhere that they could go. It was only the fact that there was a new technology that had arisen in the 13th and 14th century and the 15th century that made Columbus's journey possible. But the plan was spread Christianity.
Yeah, and certainly he intended to do this, and the crown that paid for his expeditions intended for the cross to be brought to the New World. I recommend, and of course I'm happy to talk about Christopher Columbus the next 2 hours, but I recommend people go back and find Leo XIII's apostolic letter on the on what would have been the 400th anniversary.
Oh, really?
Yes, and go
read that. In 1892.
In 1892, yep.
Joe Heschmeyer, we got you back.
Oh, look at you, yeah. Joe.
We've already solved the Columbus thing, however.
No, I want to hear what Joe has.
But, you know, I want to offer another perspective on it, actually.
You hate Columbus?
I'd say he has a deeply mixed legacy. So I want to distinguish. I think I agree with the flawed premise of a lot of the critiques, meaning that I agree that the premise of a lot of the critiques is flawed. Namely, like, you can't take a consequentialist look and say, well, after Columbus came, a lot of bad stuff happened that he didn't really intend or directly cause. That's the same thing that happens against St. Junipero Serra. You know, people say, oh, well, look at how bad the mission system got later on, through no fault of Sarah's, through, you know, it, like I say, it's like blaming Sarah for the high taxes in California. Like, yeah, he helped settle the state, and later some bad stuff happened. You can't take that kind of attenuated kind of the consequentialist view to critique him. But I think by that same coin, you can't say, well, Columbus is a great man because it led to all these tremendous consequences. It did, but sort of in spite of him. You know, like, he didn't know he was creating the Columbian Exchange until it was kind of after the fact. So I think that both the critiques and the defenses of Columbus based on the kind of unintended consequences, I'm skeptical of. That said, I think there are legitimate things that he did really good. I think there are also things that, even by the standards of the day, he could and should be critiqued for. So Warren Carroll gives a really nuanced kind of view of him. And one of the things he points out is that back in January 1495, Columbus kidnaps 1,000 slaves, 1,000 of the Indians to make them slaves. And that even Queen Isabel of Spain said that he had no authorization to treat her subjects that way. Yeah, exactly. So you can see that it isn't just like we're applying 21st century morality to the 15th century. It's that in the 15th century, there were people who looked at what Columbus was doing and say, you know, this isn't okay. And so I think there are, in terms of models of Christian behavior, Columbus falls short. You know, he has a mistress with whom he has one of his two sons. In a lot of ways, he's not a really clean-cut kind of saint. There's a reason he's not been canonized. So he kind of two cheers for Columbus. You know, he does a lot of things well, a lot of things right. But I do think there are like some legitimate grounds from a Catholic perspective upon which
for critiquing him. Yeah,
yeah, and I don't disagree with the things that Joe says. I do think his greatness can be measured simply, you know, in his own qualities. And then there is something to recognize as a consequence of what he did as well. But on the slavery question, just to be specific, Columbus does not participate in a program of chattel slavery, such as we see, for example, in the American South, all right, or in Caribbean islands later as the New World is being settled. There is a slavery or a servitude of conquered peoples. The sensibilities in the 15th century and early 16th century were quite a bit different with respect to this abject human condition than they are today, and I think that has to be taken into account. The same thing, Junipero Serra, and of course, these two men are not in the same category as Joe observes, Sarah is a canonized saint.
Yes.
And led an extremely holy life, and there's a tremendous amount of documentation to support that. But did he permit and, in fact, encourage the use of the lash as a punishment at the missions? He did. Absolutely did. And there our sensibility with respect to whipping or whatever it is quite a bit different from what it was in the 18th century.
And his perspective on a society that has millions of its citizens locked away permanently in prisons would also be quite different.
I agree.
I mean, he could critique us morally, I think, far more than we can critique him morally on those things. But that's not to excuse him. I'm not trying to excuse. And that's not.
I would say if you need a penitential system and you don't have a jail.
Yeah, you got nowhere to.
What are you going to do?
Right. And there's never been a society that jailed more people than we jail.
No, we do.
It has never happened. And also, don't care for the people in our jails. We just abandon them.
And make them look at pornography all day.
Yeah. It's horrific what happens in American jails. And then we're going to criticize someone like Father Sarah. But, okay, be that as it may. I do think that there's also, in addition to this anti-Christianity, first of all, can we also just remember that Columbus Day is a big day for Italian Americans?
It is.
And the Italian Americans should get their day. I mean, for crying out loud, my people have St. Patrick's Day. Let's, and St. Patrick was better than Columbus, clearly. Let the Italians, I just want to say that because I don't want to forget the Italians.
It is striking that the Italians have like more saints canonized than anyone on earth, literally. And they choose a guy who isn't.
Well, one of the funny things about the whole Columbus debate is, and there isn't any evidence other than the fact that he was from Genoa.
Oh, he's from Genoa.
There's no
People
question.
Are gonna say that.
Yeah, I know. But I've heard Sephardic Jew, Pole, Norwegian. Yeah.
Well, everybody.
Portuguese, Spaniard. Right. Everybody's tried to claim. But he was from Genoa.
Okay. But so we give the I leave the Italians alone. I mean, for crying out loud, it is an important day. And Columbus is not the kind of person we should be tearing down either. He's even if we go with Joe's, well, it's kind of mixed. Columbus is not a mass murderer. He's not a Pol Pot or a Stalin or something like that. He's not even a conquistador. He's an explorer who brought two huge cultures together. All of that said, what about Indigenous Peoples Day? That's what's celebrated here in California. I love it. I think we should have more of that. I just don't think you should do it on Columbus Day. It's making a battle where there should be no battle.
Yeah, it is. It's really striking. I'm reminded of the kind of racial politics in Chicago and in Texas with Mayor Daley, with the Dump Daley rallies. A lot of the controversy was that he was firing a lot of the African-American hires that he had in favor of Latino Americans. And so you ended up with these two different minority groups who were at odds with each other, kind of needlessly, because they were politically pitted against each other.
That's what's going
on. And I think there's something kind of similar here. Like in New York, Columbus Day is known as Italian American Heritage Day. So it neatly avoids the Columbus question while just acknowledging this is a day to celebrate all the contributions Italians have made. And by that standard, like an Indigenous Americans Day is totally appropriate, where you don't have to put the two against each. It doesn't have to be me or you. Like, we don't have to choose which part of the melting pot do we want to affirm. It doesn't have to be on the same day. I think that's a totally legitimate point, a totally legitimate question. And the other thing is, resituating it that way is much more dignifying, I think, to Indigenous Americans. Meaning this, like, when it's on Columbus Day, the focus is not here are all the great achievements made by, you know, Native Americans and their descendants. Rather, the focus is on this is a victimization. This is only the story of the terrible things that have happened.
Right, and that's
to American
wrong.
Indians, which I mean, to be sure, it's totally part of the history, but it's not all of the history. So we don't have to only tell the stories of suffering, only the stories of victimization. You don't build a positive cultural identity just by keeping a catalog of all the ways people have done you wrong.
Yeah, Joe's right. 90% or more of the rhetoric that surrounds Indigenous Peoples Day is the victim status and victims of Christianity.
Yeah,
and in fact, in the case of Sarah, for example, the version of events is that he forced He used the Catholic faith as a weapon, forcing it on the natives of California. So to go back to the point that I made at the very beginning of the hour, the unifying principle here amidst all the chaos and the various different contradictions is a hatred of Christianity.
And there are great native people. Perhaps we could find someone. I mean, I don't know if there are dates related to the great peacemaker, you know, but this is an important person in history who's not taught about in schools. I don't know if we have any actual biographical dates that go with him, but why not pick a great native person, a great American, you know, a Native American person, and have a celebrate the day that and
good Catholics like Black Elk or Sitting Bull.
Right. And why not underscore the fact that it's the church in the main that stands up for the rights of natives against secular governments?
We've got to take a break. We'll be right back with more of our panel show on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Having a panel discussion about stuff that's going on in the world today. A little bit of we don't all perfectly agree on the canceling of Christopher Columbus, but I think profitable conversation. We'll move on to other topics of the day. But Joe, Chris Check, our president, was reminding me at the break that you did a talk at our conference that's related to this.
Yeah, it was a beautiful talk.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, the talk. So the theme of the conference was who do you say that he is? Or, who, you know, so it's based on Matthew 16 when Jesus says, who do you say that I am? And the theme of my talk within that is to recognize that Peter only discovers his own identity as Simon Peter once he's able to confess Jesus as the Christ. And I held that up in the face of all of the different things competing to be our identities today. First and foremost, this idea of what's called identity politics. That it's very powerful to say, hey, you're this group, you know, based on your sex or your ethnicity or your race or your sexual orientation or your gender identity or fill in the blank, that you are X. And therefore, you're with us. This is your team. The other side is the other team. And especially for political things, you really need to think this way. You need to vote this way. You know, if you're a woman, you have to be pro-choice, that kind of idea. And in the face of that, I was saying, you know, look, what that gets right is this. If we don't know who we are, we don't know how to act. So it's important to know your identity. But we can also see that the identities that the world gives are are kind of superficial and shallow, and they don't get to the heart of the human person. Like, you are more than your ethnicity. You're more than your family. You're more than, you know, your skin color or your height or your gender or your sexual attractions or fill in the blank. You're more than all of those things. You're a son or daughter of God, and that's like your deepest identity. So if you get that right, that's a proper orientation for action. You know how to behave if you get that right. But then within that, you can still, like, you can find places for the legitimate aspects of identity as well. You know, like Saint Joan of Arc, it matters that she's French. It matters that she's female, but only if you first get the bit about her being Catholic right.
Yeah, yeah. It would be great if the conversations with the woke could begin with where Joe has begun.
Yeah, right. The most important thing is your identity as a child of God. And then we'll start there, and then we'll move out from there.
Yeah.
Which I think is why the church is the first real multicultural, non-governmental organization.
In fact, it's the only one.
Yeah. I mean, the church didn't care. In the early days of the gospel, literally could not care less what your culture was, what your race was. All that mattered was to get this news that God so loved you that he had given his life on the cross for you.
Yeah. Greek or Jew.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you can see this in a lot of early art where, like, Europeans are depicting Africans. And sometimes the depictions come off as a little, like, maybe awkward by modern sensibilities. But it's a gentle kind of idle curiosity. It isn't like a hatred. It isn't like an intentional caricature like you see in, like, later blackface or something like that, where it's meant to mock. It's much more like the way a kid might draw someone who looks different than them. And they're just like, oh, that's really interesting and fascinating. There really is this sense in which all of the race and ethnicity stuff that we've come to think of as just kind of a permanent part of society is a consequence of the failure of Christianity to kind of embrace the full nature of the humanity of man, especially in the 15th century and beyond.
So can I ask Joe a follow-up question here? I would like to pin some of this failure on the Protestant Reformation, which seems to me to have clear ethnic identities with its various factions.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think if we want to go back even further, you get the seeds of it in the Great Schism between the
sure.
East and the West.
East and West.
There's much more of a national dimension to it. But so you have, even before the Reformation, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg. You see, starting in the mid-1200s, the beginnings of the rise of powerful nation states. And they become a counterbalance to people's Catholic identities. Like, if you're going to, like, the early 1200s, people might be English or French or what have you today. But a lot of those boundaries were shifting. And a lot of those kind of national loyalties, so to speak, were pretty weak because a lot of the nations were pretty weak. And so you were Catholic first and foremost, and people understood that. And you got that even after the Reformation. The Battle of Lepanto is a great example of people putting aside national differences to go and fight for Christendom. But you also see the people who aren't joining that project, and it is the Protestant reformers. One of the first clear examples of this is Martin Luther's letter to the German princes, where he really argues the German state should have authority, and he makes it very explicitly, like, we don't want German tithe money going to support Italians. That's one of his big arguments right. that he makes to the Germans. And so he leans into this notion of German identity, which very quickly spills over to treating the Jews as not quite German enough because they're not Christian. And like, if you read his Against the Jews or On the Jews and Their Lies, like, it is shockingly anti-Semitic, and Hitler would later use it to ill effect. But Luther is laying the seeds of that at the foundation of really building up this idea of the German state as this distinctly Germanic and distinctly Protestant kind of thing. You see this with the Dutch when the Battle of Lepanto is happening, when there's this great existential fight as we're trying to save Christianity. Some
the Spanish
of the Dutch Protestants.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, exactly. They start making these crescents that say better Turk than Papist,
right.
To say they would rather be under Muslim rule than under Catholic rule. That kind of idea, you really start to see an incredible splintering of Christian against Christian. Now, that had been there long before, but it's really dialed up. And so I think it's a combination of the rise of nation states
it's institutionalized.
And the rise of Protestants.
in a way.
Yes.
Yeah, it has institutions that can perpetuate it now, and we still do that. We still there's many Americans, for example, who think their identity is our brother and sister Christians and Catholics who think that the American identity is synonymous with their Christian identity. And no sense of one is far the more important than the other.
Exactly. I mean, I always cringe a little bit at the presence of American flags in Catholic churches, but it is that idea.
I'm supposed to be the big liberal here. Chris always says, oh, Cy's our big liberal. Look at you. You're staking out.
I know. I'm too tratty for American flags in Catholic churches.
Yeah, you're too tratty.
I don't think they should be in the sanctuary either.
Yeah, it's because and that's actually like one of the dangers with treating Columbus Day is just like, look, Italians are just as good of Americans. There was this long process by which Catholics tried to prove they were no different than their Protestant brothers and sisters in America. And it was a moral disaster and has got us in the situation we're in today. We should have said, yeah, we're different. We actually disagree with a lot of the things the founding fathers believed because they're operating on this like Reformation Enlightenment project we don't agree with. Well, there's some overlap, but they're not going to be on all fours with everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit easy to say that in hindsight when, you know, you don't have eight kids to feed and you need a job. And, you know, it's a little hard not to, you know, try to assimilate in those situations. Okay, so I feel like we have touched on the whole Columbus Day and the kind of just implicit anti-Christianity that's in all.
It's explicit. I think it's explicit. It is in your face, explicit, Cy.
All right, let me give you some other explicit anti-Christianity. I get a kick. I always read her every time she has a column in the New York Times, Linda Greenhouse. I don't know, Joe, you're a lawyer if you're familiar with Linda Greenhouse. She's the legal reporter or the legal opinion. Well, she's a reporter for the New York Times.
Cy, God bless you for reading the New York Times. Is that in your job description?
You got to know what they're saying.
Or is that penance?
But you can't believe the insanity of it sometimes is shocking.
Yes.
Like they say things and you go, do they not, like, I don't know. You basic rules of civility and humanity are absent in many cases. So Linda Greenhouse is a trip because I've rarely run across a writer who's wrong every single time. But but Linda manages it. And of course, she hates the Supreme Court, this conservative Supreme Court. But I just want to read you a piece from – remember in the – of course you do remember that Texas law that got passed and nobody thought it was anything until one morning we wake up and the Supreme Court didn't overturn it. And everyone's like, wait a second, does that mean abortion's illegal in Texas now? And nobody told us this was coming. And so Linda wrote this, Linda Greenhouse, the great Linda Greenhouse. The Supreme Court has come in for plenty of well-deserved criticism for last week's midnight maneuver, allowing Texas to enforce its new abortion law. The fact that the four of the court's six Roman Catholic justices and a fifth who was raised Catholic but is now Episcopalian, all conservative, allowed a blatantly unconstitutional law to remain in place pending appeal has barely been noted publicly. And she's going to correct that. She's going to correct that, that this is Catholics imposing their will on all of us good Americans. Religion in America's this paragraph kills me. Religion in American society is American society's last taboo. We can talk about sexual identity, gender nonconformity, all manner of topics one considered too intimate for open discussion, but we have yet to find a deaf and effective way to question the role of religion in public officials' political or judicial agenda. Well, that's because that's what the nation was founded on, Linda, but without opening ourselves to accusations of being anti-religious. Who would accuse Linda Greenhouse of being anti-religious after that? Can you imagine?
Like the thing that I think people don't get is a lot of the people who view this as basically okay are assuming that Catholics have been this long-standing, really powerful bloc in the U.S. And that's, historically speaking, never been really true. Like, we had a brief flirtation with social acceptance, and then kind of receded.
You're forgetting the police force in Boston and New York.
Yeah, those were Irish cops.
The famous paddy wagon in which the paddies were in the front and in the back.
Yeah.
but, yeah, so Article 6... Clause 3 of the Constitution forbids any kind of religious test for public office. And the reason is to stop this kind of flagrant you know, hypocrisy and religious persecution. Like, this is very much what we tried to leave behind in Europe, because this is the kind of stuff that led to incredible warfare. Like, you wouldn't say, hey, you know, a lot of the liberal justices in the last three decades have been Jewish, and therefore we shouldn't have Jewish people on the Supreme Court. Like, it's totally
a third rail.
You would, right. You know, and so just leave it alone. And so I did say a couple things. First, this is maybe a new and ugly manifestation of something that's been going on for a while. There was a book back in the 1940s called American Freedom and Catholic Power by a fellow by the name of Paul Blanchard. Yeah, exactly. He was, I believe, assistant editor of The Nation. He was very much coming from this kind of liberal perspective, but this kind of Yankee liberalism that is still pretty deeply anti-Catholic. And that's nothing new. Like, go back to, like, 1876, where the Democratic Party got ridiculed as the party of rum, rebellion, and Romanism, because the Puritan kind of descendants up in the North were pro-prohibition, they were anti-Southern, and they were anti-Catholic. And so that was like what they viewed the GOP as standing for back then. What I mean to say is that it's been easy political game to pick on Catholics for a very long time, even from what we normally think of as like the progressive or liberal left. Philip Jenkins has a good book on this called The New Anti-Catholicism, The Last Acceptable Prejudice, back in early 2003. And Jenkins is an ex-Catholic, I believe.
An Anglican. Anglican now.
But he does a very good, very fair job without whining or anything like that, but just to show instance after instance where these things are pretty shockingly said against Catholics that you would never say against basically any other group. And without any good defense of it other than, well, we don't like where a lot of conservative Catholics' politics lie.
So this is like the quote outside of our studio here from G.K. Chesterton, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but the world is constantly paying a compliment to the Catholic Church because it is the one institution that they love to criticize.
Yeah, and they hold us to our own standards.
Right.
And where no one else is held to their standards. But I would just like to point, I'm going to play some audio for you from National Public Radio. Do you think you can survive audio from National Public Radio? Right after the break. But this struck me so much in her complaint that we can't talk about that this is these dirty, rotten Catholics who are overturning abortion. We can't talk about it. She says, we can talk about sexual identity, gender nonconformity, all manner of topics considered too intimate for open discussion. Wait, no, we can't. I'm not allowed to talk about, I don't believe in gender nonconformity. I think that's bad for society. Like, what world does she live in where it's okay, where I could criticize, say, the transgender identity, and I'm welcome to do that on Twitter? I'm not welcome to do that on Twitter. They will turn me off.
Nor, by the way, Cy, is this measure in Texas in particular an exclusively Catholic thing. Texas now there are more and more Catholics moving to Texas and the population, the Catholic population in Texas has continued to grow, but it is largely a Baptist or evangelical state. So the authors of this law and the people who put the elected officials in office are not altogether Catholics.
Yeah. That's exactly right, and the pro-life cause has been taken up by a great variety of people. But the truth is, when Roe versus Wade is overturned, if it is in the next year, it's going to be a Catholic who writes the opinion, and we're going to hear more about this. So I want to play some audio about us Catholics and the abortion debate from National Public Radio right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
you're doing a live program and you're thinking about what they're saying and what the audience is wanting you to say and all the stuff going on. Part of that is having this wonderful opportunity to hear these people. I'm quite sure I've heard over 1,000 conversion stories. And when you hear this, you have this opportunity of asking the question, oh, like, Lord, what was it that opened this person's heart to you? What did you use?
The Journey Home with Marcus Grodi, Monday night, 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're having a fun conversation. I think it's fun. Anyways, I love talking with Joe and Chris. Joe Heschmeyer, an apologist here at Catholic Answers. Chris Check, our president. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And we're just discussing the news of the world from a Catholic perspective. And we'll do that next hour as well. I haven't let anybody on. I haven't even looked to see if we have calls. I'm gonna do that in a minute because we got to play some audio from National Public Radio. Okay, so Alyssa Chang, who I listen to every afternoon on National Public Radio.
Is in your job description?
I have a long commute, right? And so for some reason, I have to find out what they're saying on National Public Radio every afternoon. And it's not the world I live in. Let's just put it that way. So I like exposing myself to...
You are from Massachusetts.
I'm from... Just knock it off. So Alyssa Chang is...
You guys live in California.
Yeah, well, that's right. We live in California now. And he's making fun of me because I'm from Massachusetts. She's got a kind of a sing-songy voice and reporter, and she's always just shocked and amazed at the new things she's learning. And one of them... is in this report that they did celebrating a woman from San Francisco who was a very early pro-abortion, not just pro-choice, but a pro-abortion activist. And they've never done that for a pro-life activist. I've never heard that. But they took, 16 minutes, I think, to talk about this woman who had died who was a pro-abortion activist back in the 60s. But I just wanted to share some of the insights. So will you do clip one, the quickening one? And here's what they had to say about abortion. What they did in part, just so you know, is kind of a history of abortion in America and what people and when it became kind of a hot button issue. And go ahead.
As I pictured what it would have been like to live as a woman during this time, I was fascinated to learn that this wasn't what most of American history was like. You see, during the 17 and early 1800s in the U.S., ending a pregnancy was totally permissible under the law, at least up until a point known as quickening.
Quickening is when a woman could feel fetal movement inside of her.
And Regan says in the months before quickening, a pregnant person could deliberately self-induce a miscarriage without any penalty. Even the Catholic Church at the time did not condemn this practice.
What do you think of that history? Either one of you? I mean, the Catholic Church.
I don't think it deserves to be called history.
This is a lie.
The Catholic Church has opposed abortion from its very first document that's not in the Bible, specifically opposed abortion from the very first non-biblical document. That abortion is not mentioned in the scriptures. But the very first document that the church wrote that we have that exists outside the scriptures specifically mentions abortion. So she's saying in the 1750s, not even the Catholic Church opposed this.
Well, actually, let me nuance what you just said just slightly. There's a dispute about whether or not abortion is mentioned in the scriptures because of the use of the Greek word pharmakia.
Yeah.
So in Galatians 5:19-21, one of the things it talks about is those who indulge in pharmakia. It's the root word of our word pharmacy. And we likewise see it in Revelation 9:21 and Revelation 18:23. So three times the use of pharmakia is condemned. Now, what makes this tricky is pharmakia is kind of a complicated word. It's the use of, like, potions and drugs, and it had three uses, sorcery, birth control, and abortion.
Oh.
And so those are kind of collectively being condemned, seemingly.
I see.
It's true there's not, like, an extremely specific chemical abortion is specifically wrong, but the use of drugs in this kind of manner was condemned three times in the New Testament.
Chris, what's your take on this history lesson we're getting?
Well, it's dishonest, but what I would ask her is, okay, very well. Well, now that science has progressed and we have evidence of quickening at a much earlier state, now I know there's a controversy over what a fetal heartbeat is and is this an electric signal, et cetera, and I leave that to Trent and everything. But because science and the technology are that much better, and she should, according to her own, the logic of her own narrative there, support the Texas law.
Right. Exactly. Well, this is what is striking to me about it. And I've got another clip I want to play, and you've kind of jumped the gun on it a little bit. But
if I can add one more thing, just okay. In terms of like the legal perspective. Quickening, like, so Henry Bracton, who is one of the major influences on English and later American common law, he, back in the 13th century, said if one strikes a pregnant woman or gives her poison in order to procure an abortion, if the fetus is already formed or quickened, especially if it is quickened, he commits homicide. So there is a twofold kind of test. Either, basically, you know, you can feel the child moving in your womb, clearly the child's alive, or, you know, you are struck or you have an abortion and or you miscarry and you see like a fully formed child comes out. Well, that's a really good sign that you had a child in your womb. So it was never quite as simple as she's saying. Like the law was always more complicated than that. And even before that, like even before quickening, it wasn't it's fine. It was that it was treated as a misdemeanor and it was called a very heinous misdemeanor. Rather than as a felony.
And by the way, this is the same country in which contraception was outlawed.
Yeah.
And the trafficking in contraceptions between states was against the law. So
that's
so,
where the phrase banned in Boston comes from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, will you play the second clip? Because there's a mystery that she cannot solve, which is sometime around the 1860s, the United States began to ban abortion. And she doesn't know why this happened in the 19th century. I have a pretty good idea why it happened, and I'd like to tell her. But first, let's just hear this second clip.
It's quiet. It's not talked about.
It's not debated.
Exactly.
Like, there wasn't this nationwide conversation about whether that was ending life.
Yeah, there isn't a public debate. It's just part of commonplace health care.
But eventually, states start outlawing abortion in the mid-1800s, and then the legal landscape begins to shift even more in the 20th century.
Okay, let me just give you two dates, 1827 and 1876. In 1827, the mammal ovum is identified for the first time by a scientist named Bayer. That happened in 1827. Then the science of embryology began once they realized there was an egg inside of mammals. 1827 is when that happened. So embryology develops, and the American Medical Association realizes in the 1850s that abortion is killing fertilized human eggs. And so the American Medical Association lobbies for it to be illegal. In 1876, and I'll forget the name of the scientist now, in 1876, there's a scientist who proves that the way that the mammal life begins is that sperm makes contact with the ovum. So now in 1876, we know how life begins in a mammal. So it's related to science. Science told us when life begins. That's why the anti-abortion laws began. But for Alyssa Chang, this is just a mystery. Like for some reason in the 19th century, there started to be these anti-abortion laws. It's because science.
Right. So when we're talking about this from a pro-life perspective, sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I wonder which other laws of the 19th century Alyssa Chang would like to go back to.
Yeah,
since she's so enthusiastic for the legal precedents of the middle of the 19th century and before.
Yeah, yeah.
And specifically medical laws. Like this is when you get the standardization. Like you stop being able to just sell snake oil because the American Medical Association starts to actually crack down on just insanity. Like it's so. The AMA is only founded in 1847. So we are talking about like really like the emergence of a professional standard of healthcare coming to this country midway through the 19th century.
Right.
So to say that was a mistake because like it meant you couldn't do illegal abortions. Like, it's just, it's madness.
It's all a mystery to Alyssa Chang, though. Why did we ever start treating fetal life as real human life? Why did we start caring about embryos? Well, there's a little thing called modern science that happened. It wasn't the church that did this. It wasn't some crazy, wild-eyed conservatives. It was the scientists who figured it out. And the church accepts that science and says, hey, you know what? That means that the commandment against killing applies to that life as well.
Yeah. If it's true, it belongs to us.
It's not the rejection of science. It's the acceptance that led to the pro-life movement. We'll continue with our panel discussion right after this on Catholic Answers Live.